This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal says Pennsylvania's attempts to silence him is par for the course. A professor of international law charges the United States is waging biological warfare against Africa. And Dr. Cornel West speaks on black prophetic fire. But first, the water crisis continues in Detroit, where more than 27,000 households have had their water shut off for non-payment of bills. On November 1st, a grassroots group called the Detroit Water Brigade will hold a march in solidarity with the people of Dublin, Ireland, where fees for water use are being imposed for the first time. At Peace Makita is a spokeswoman for the Detroit Water Brigade. She talks about the Irish connection.
Our overall motivation is that water is a human right, that everybody has the right to water, and that access to fresh, clean water should not be denied. A couple of weeks ago in Ireland, they are having issues with the privatization of their water and were recently told that they would be receiving water bills, and their water has usually been paid through their taxes. So once they heard about that, over 100,000 people turned out in the streets in protest, letting the powers that be know that they didn't want their water privatized and that they don't want to have to start paying for water out of their own pocket. And in that demonstration, we found out that there was solidarity in Ireland with Detroit, that they too have been watching us and support us as well in our fight to have water accessible to those who cannot afford it. So the link was brought in by the protesters pretty much. There were a few posters saying, you know, we stand in solidarity with Detroit Water Brigade. And privatizing water is a serious concern for just basic simple reasons, and that's survival. And to also show that this is a global issue. This is not a local issue. This is not an African-American issue. This is not a poverty issue. This is a human rights issue. This is a necessity for life issue.
And yet another international connection, two UN rapporteurs have issued a statement saying that the denial of water to poor Detroiters constitutes a possible race discrimination abuse as well as a human rights abuse.
We were kind of shocked that the local officials would be so disrespectful of the rapporteurs of the UN. But in hindsight, where I'm really looking at the way the local officials and state officials have been handling this water issue since its inception, it's really not a surprise. I mean, they've been very flippant and not getting what the real issue is, because for them, the concerns of the people is not a real issue for them. You know, they're really trying to get this debt off of their backs. They're really trying to keep money in their pockets and those types of things. So that's pretty much our feeling, is that we know, and we've always known, that we, the people, are the ones that are going to have to make this happen. That's why the brigade was formed in the first place, was because we realized that it's not going to come from City Hall, and it's not going to come from other organizations that are fighting on a political front. That's good, and we need that. But we also need to remember that the people are the ones who are being affected every day. You know, that those that are actually going without are being affected. So it's disheartening, but at the same time, this is the level of mentality that we've had to deal with this entire time, which is why we are in the situation that we're in. So,
and that's why you're having this march on November 1st. What's your demand?
Our main demand, our main goal in the march is to show solidarity, to show that this is a global concern, to really step it up a notch and get it out of the smaller-minded views of, oh, this is about money, and oh, this is about race, and oh, those views, of course, are attached to the issue, but the reality is the same, is that everyone needs water. You have water flowing through your body majority, the planet is majority water, your brain sits in water, babies come through water, everything living on the planet requires water for that life to be sustained. That is the number one principle and goal that we want people to understand. You know, you can attach all these other things to it, and a lesser mind will, but the reality, the root of it, goes far beyond that. And it goes to the the real concern of just life, period, and being and people being able to sustain their live their life.
Reportedly, 27,000 households have been affected by the cutoff. What kinds of hardships has that resulted in?
That has resulted in many hardships. I mean, I personally have had my water shut off in the past, and I have five small children. So the hardship, I mean, just being able to manage and care for yourself on a daily basis, that's hardship enough. Not being able to clean yourself and cook properly and just waking up every day with all of the things you have to deal with and think about, how am I going to flush my toilet? Or, oh, wow, I have to cut out an extra 2 or 3 hours of my day to get over to a family member's house to give everybody baths and showers because I don't have water in my house. Like, it creates a huge unnecessary inconvenience to someone, and it really causes psychologically, it causes a lot of problems because how hard is it? I mean, you're living literally around water, water all around you, but you don't have it, or you're being denied it because you're a bad person because you didn't pay a bill. Like, the psychological effects that that has is a lot for someone to deal with, especially if they're already dealing with unemployment or if they're already dealing with the illness or something like that. They have to then compound that with the psychological burden of, there's water all around me, but I'm being denied. And then if you are sick or disabled or something like that, then I can only imagine the compound on that. So it's very traumatic. It's a very traumatic experience.
The city claims that it's come up with ways to make it easier for poor people. Are those adequate plans?
No, not at all. Those plans are appeasement. Those plans are, in their minds, appeasing the individual or appeasing the public to say, see, we're not as bad as everybody says we are. And no one's saying that they're bad. It's just that the plan or the process in which they're following is not meeting the need. And that's a big concern of mine. If you are a leader of something, then how do you know that you're being an effective leader? Because you're meeting the needs of those that you lead, period. You know what I'm saying? If the needs of the people that you're leading are not being met, then you, my friend, are not an effective leader. So, no, it's not working simply because the plan that they put in place, in no consideration does it take into account a person's income. And when you're creating a payment plan, if the person needs a payment plan, it's obvious because they can't meet the requirement, right? So why can't they meet the requirement? Usually that's because of income or the flow of money going back and forth. Okay, so then let's create a plan where this debt can be paid, and it can be paid, and I know it'll be paid because I'm going to go according to the money that you can provide or that you're getting in, right? That is what a good business person or a wise, logical business person might do if they want to successfully sustain their business. Detroit is not doing that. Detroit has come up with a plan that has no consideration of a person's income. It's not income-based at all. It's only based on the debt and how that debt can be handled or eradicated within 24 months. So the payment plan that you get on is, number one, not based on your income. It's based on the debt. And number two, it will be an added expense to your monthly bill. So if you go into, you get 10% down to get the payment plan started. They give you 24 months to pay off the debt, and they break down the payments in those 24 months. And then that payment is attached to your current monthly bill. So not only have you set me up with a plan, you know, because I can't afford to pay my original bill, but then now I have my original payment due, and on top of that, I have additional payment that I have to pay. So I already couldn't pay my bill. I get on a payment plan, and now I have to pay more. And I'm expected to do that, or there will be penalties for it.
Well, that sounds like a plan that's designed for the customer to fail, which leads one to think that they actually want to get people out of Detroit.
Yes, there's been a lot of talk about that. And at this point, because of what I'm experiencing and because of what's happening, I no longer can just dismiss that argument. I mean, all arguments are valid at the end of the day because psychologically it's not making sense. It's not adding up, you know, why this is happening. So you have to start to really take in the possibilities of everything. So that's very much a possibility that they're trying to move people out, that they're, you know, sectioning off certain parts of the city so that they can take it over and make that all, you know, private or make money from it or whatever the motive is. But it's pretty obvious that there is a motive, and no one really knows what it is, so we talk about it.
27,000 people is a lot of folks, and there's a lot more who feel threatened by these new water policies and other policies in Detroit. you should have a good turnout on November 1st.
I hope so. I mean, we haven't really been having a lot of turnout, not just our organization, but other organizations as well. That's been a concern because the residents either aren't really well-versed on the subject to know or to really understand that, hey, this is, you know, a serious problem. Literacy or illiteracy is extremely high in the city, too. So really getting people to just comprehend what's happening is a challenge. And then as well as people being busy and working and just not really paying it much attention because they're trying to pay their bills, you know. So there's a lot of different factors that are hindering people from actually coming out and really showing that type of support and protest the way they have in Dublin. But we are definitely expecting people to come out that they can, to come out and show that they care. We'll give them a space and a vessel to do that.
That was At Peace Makita of the Detroit Water Brigade. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are preparing to fight a new Pennsylvania state law specially tailored to silence the nation's best-known political prisoner. The measure would allow the suppression of state prisoners' speech that might cause mental anguish to victims of crimes. The Silence Mumia bill passed the Pennsylvania State House of Representatives unanimously. We asked Brett Grote, legal director of the Abolitionist Law Center, if that lopsided vote surprised him.
Slightly. I mean, 197-0 is the sort of support that you only see from a legislative body, say, if it's the U.S. Congress supporting the Israeli state and its onslaught on the Palestinians. It's that degree of submissiveness and servility to the Fraternal Order of Police did raise my eyebrows, especially when the bill itself is transparently unconstitutional for a number of reasons. It really, I think, should serve as a wake-up call to those who feel that a Democratic-Republican convergence of interests in lowering the cost of mass incarceration is anything other than a total sham for maintaining the status quo. When you see them line up behind the Fraternal Order of Police like this and attack Mumia in a symbolic way in order to reestablish the narrative of who the police are and what their function is, I think it should serve as a wake-up call to which side those in power are really on.
We've been hearing Mumia's voice and reading his writings for years now. Prison Radio have been promulgating his message weekly for years. What set off the Pennsylvania government that they would go into a kind of legislative hysteria?
It was ostensibly his being invited to give a commencement speech to a graduating class at Goddard College in Vermont. He has done this before in 2008. He's also given commencement speeches at Antioch College and, I believe, Evergreen in Washington State. These had never produced this type of concerted effort to shut him down, and so I think there's other factors that are at play here, one of those being Governor Corbett's failing political prospects for re-election. He's at risk of becoming the first one-term governor in the state of Pennsylvania since the 70s or the 60s. So he has latched on to Mumia giving this commencement address as a way to try to engage in a standard trope for Pennsylvania politicians, which is race baiting, fear mongering around issues of crime and using Mumia as somebody to beat up on for political gain. But I also think what I had alluded to before, the Fraternal Order of Police has a national agenda, and when they want to advance it, they oftentimes do it by targeting the person of Mumia. They did this when Barack Obama recently nominated somebody to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department that they did not want, and they connected the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's representation of Mumia Abu-Jamal and his challenge to his conviction and sentence in a way to smear him. And they are very much frantically trying to reestablish the lie that police forces are the protectors of public safety and that other institutions of violence, such as prisons, are necessary to protect the public. And in the wake of Ferguson, it is more necessary than ever for them to do this, as the role of these institutions are being criticized perhaps more than they have been in a generation.
This seems to be a new kind of species of law. It makes legally actionable prisoner speech that causes what they call mental anguish among the families of victims of crime.
Correct. The conduct at issue is defined solely in relation to its effect on the victim. It is written so broadly that it can include everything from a prisoner appealing for commutation to a former offender perhaps engaging in public speech on the airwaves or doing anything which is likely to cause mental anguish. It could relate to somebody proclaiming their innocence, to somebody protesting conditions of confinement inside of the prisons, and it is explicitly designed to target otherwise lawful speech. The state of Pennsylvania has tried to silence Mumia in the past, obviously by trying to kill him, and the 1990s, however, the prison system itself imposed a restriction against him that he is not to practice a profession, and they tried to shut him down that way. Mumia went into federal court in a case called Abu Jamal v. Price, and he beat that regulation back, even under the relaxed standards for First Amendment rights that are afforded to prisoners. So the conduct at issue here is as wide as the universe of human conduct possible, and the only definitive characteristic under the statute is that it has to cause some type of mental anguish on the victim. And as the very mainstream Harrisburg Patriot newspaper noted, for many victims, the fact that the offender is still breathing, it causes mental anguish. And so this conduct of breathing could, under the text of the law, allow them to go into court to try to get an injunction against that conduct. It's clearly absurd on its face.
And what about those who facilitate this transmission of mental anguish? People like yourself, people like me, people out there who reproduce the words and speech of prisoners of Pennsylvania.
In the House Judiciary Committee, when there was discussion over the scope of a court's powers under this law, those who drafted the bill clearly indicated that they intended for a court to be able to enjoin the conduct of what they refer to as third-party vessels. So Prison Radio, Black Agenda Report, Democracy Now!, or any number of prison abolitionists or prisoner rights organizations that work with people inside prison and publicize their statements. Under this law, they can face a court order prohibiting them from transmitting, broadcasting, or otherwise disseminating messages that the court has deemed cause mental anguish.
So with the help of the state of Pennsylvania, the families of people who feel they have been victimized by people in prison can reach out and actually throttle the speech of virtually any other American.
Correct. It totally eviscerates the First Amendment for anybody that has been convicted of a personal injury crime. It can be members of the private bar working with victims as their personal attorneys to take this on, or as is more likely, the district attorney where the crime was committed, or the state attorney general. In what is another unusual aspect of this law, it allows for state officials to essentially act as the private attorneys for the victims and use taxpayer money to bring an injunctive suit in state court.
What are the prospects of this law being upheld constitutionally, and does Pennsylvania care?
Well, the Pennsylvania legislature clearly does not care, and their reputation for lawlessness is beyond the scope of this interview, but it's quite considerable. Myself and with the Abolitionist Law Center and the Amistad Law Project in Philadelphia and some others are preparing to challenge this in court, and it would require a drastic rewriting of a number of key First Amendment principles and precedents in order for this to be upheld. So we're quite confident. The ACLU of Pennsylvania even stated in a memo to legislators that the only people who will benefit from this bill are the attorneys who are successful in federal court in getting it struck down. So, attorneys can tend to be a cautious breed in predicting how likely they are to win in any piece of litigation, but they felt confident enough in making that quite definitive statement about the prospects of the bill.
And have the folks at Prison Radio made any changes in their day-to-day operations dealing with Mumia and other prisoners in light of this law?
No, but since there has been this push, there have been, if anything, more broadcasts from Prison Radio, quote, interviewing Mumia and his own responses to it, and just a further dedication to continue to bring the voices of prisoners to the broader public discussions about mass incarceration, about white supremacy, about torture and solitary confinement, and other things related to the criminal legal system. So there's been no changes, and there has been, if anything, a renewed commitment and even increased output in the wake of this latest provocation.
Brett Grote of the Abolitionist Law Center. Mumia Abu-Jamal continues to speak out from the state prison in Freckville, Pennsylvania. He says the legislature and the courts have always been eager to change the rules in his case.
Anyone even remotely familiar with my case knows about the Mumia rule. That's when the court or agency changes its rule or precedent to go against me. When Amnesty International wrote about my case, that was its essential focus, that laws and precedents that applied to other cases would be changed when it came to me. In fact, when my habeas corpus case went before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, one judge, in dissent, Judge Ambrose, said, essentially, I know of no reason why we don't apply our precedents to Abu-Jamal. There was one reason, the Mumia Rule. Now the Mumia Rule has been enacted into law, the so-called Victim Revictimization Act, signed into law by unconstitutional Tom, Pennsylvania's governor, Tom Corbett. What makes this remarkable is that Corbett, the former attorney general, knows perfectly well that this is an unconstitutional law in violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. He knows this, for he's a lawyer. And he also knows that an unconstitutional law is no law at all. Interestingly, he's so much a politician that he was busy running for governor when, under his very nose, children were being raped and abused in the Penn State scandal. As attorney general, he was on Penn State's board of trustees at the time. These rapes and molestations were happening and did next to nothing until the scandal broke. Oh, he reportedly received a generous campaign contribution from the chairman of the board and members of the foundation run by Jerry Sandusky, the central figure in the Penn State scandal. Nice job, Tom. Too busy picking up campaign contributions to protect the kids? Every politician and every lawyer who supported this so-called law did so by knowingly violating their oath of office to protect and defend the Pennsylvania Constitution, Article 1, Section 7, and the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They took an oath to honor the Constitution, not their campaign contributors. They took an oath to protect the constitutional rights of all Pennsylvanians, not just their funders, the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Pigs. By violating their oaths, they bring disrepute on their oaths and their office. By signing a law they knew to be unconstitutional, they departed from the realm of lawmakers and became legislative outlaws. They passed the Mumia Rule, yes, but the damage they have done is greater to themselves than to me.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal. The White House announced that it was temporarily calling a halt to new funding for experiments in making infectious diseases into weapons of war. But the statement did not mention Ebola. A Liberian newspaper charged that the U.S. is responsible for the Ebola outbreak in West Africa through its secret Ebola research on human beings in Sierra Leone. Dr. Francis Boyle is professor of international law at the University of Illinois. He says the U.S. has been preparing for biological warfare for more than 40 years.
The reason they did not mention Ebola in the Friday New York Times late afternoon story where everyone buries the news is because if people had looked and found Ebola on that list, then they'd ask themselves, well, what were they doing with Ebola? Why were they GMOing genetically modified organism Ebola to make it more lethal, to make it more dangerous? So that's why Ebola isn't on the list. But this is an exercise in CYA, cover your own rear end, that they realize things got out of control over there in West Africa, and it's an exercise in CYA. So far, it appears they're getting away with it because the mainstream news media just refuses to touch this story. They're simply going along with the CDC cover-up. The CDC was up to its nose in this prohibited biowarfare research over in Kenema, Sierra Leone. I have an official Pentagon document proving CDC was doing biowarfare work over in Sierra Leone as early as 1988, and they must have been there sooner in order to construct that lab. So this is all a cover-up here. We're seeing by CDC, the Obama administration, Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health, NIAID, and all the rest of them. They know that U.S. biowarfare programs are behind this, and they're doing their best to cover it up. And so far, they've been very successful because the mainstream news media won't touch it. And there's a very good reason why the mainstream news media won't touch it, Glenn, because during the course of the anthrax attacks of October 2001, that was clearly United States government sources, they also hit the mainstream news media. So the mainstream news media got the message that, you know, if you cover this story, you could be killed. And I kid you not on that, as we know, there are now at least 26 or 7 dead microbiologists, dead. And I believe the reason for that is that they told their superiors, they threatened to blow the whistle on illegal, criminal, dangerous biological weapons programs. That information was forwarded along, and they were terminated. So this is very serious business, as you know, especially there in West Africa. If you look at the predicted fatalities, this will be genocidal.
When you said 27 scientists dead, I assumed you meant from contagion, from diseases spawned by their experiments, but not dead as in assassinated.
Yeah, they all died under highly questionable circumstances, right? All of them, every one of them, not just from their own research, no. There's a big list on the internet. You can check it out if you want, who these people are and how they died. I think they were all terminated because they threatened to blow the whistle. But hey, dead men tell no tales. But yeah, someone asked me, well, if this was going on for so many years, then why weren't there whistleblowers? And I said, well, there were whistleblowers, and they're all dead. So, you know, I think the mainstream news media has the message to stay away from this.
I think this may be the first time in history also that the United States, its media and government, paid any attention to what was said in a Liberian newspaper or any African newspaper, which reported that these experiments were going on in Sierra Leone.
Well, I did see that, yes. And, you know, the mainstream news media, everyone has done their best to explain it away or ignore it or just say, well, it was published over there, so who's going to pay any attention to it, right? So they're being very effective here in stage managing in the mainstream news media, which would reach millions of people, and just keep it down to the internet and the alternative news media sources like you. Obama needs to keep this all under control until after the November 4 election, when the Senate could turn over to the Republicans. And that's why I brought in this guy, Ron Klein. He has no qualifications except he's a political fixer and a buddy of Obama's from Harvard Law School. That's all. So he's, you know, he's going to sit there and try to stage manage this thing and keep it under control, at least until after the election, sort of like what they did on the Benghazi talking points. Only this is far more serious, especially for the people of West Africa.
Now that the microbe is out of the bag, so to speak, I suppose that the United States will then defend itself by saying that everybody's involved in this kind of weaponizing of biology.
Well, that's the argument. The problem is the Biological Weapons Convention and the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act makes no exceptions. But it goes back to the Reagan administration for sure. The U.S. did have an offensive biological warfare industry here in the United States, exposed by Seymour Martin Hirsch in 1968. He had a book. Then Nixon signed the Biological Weapons Convention. At that point, I think a lot of it went underground, very few traces of it, but we still see evidence of it with these, you know, if you read the news media, all these old vials of biowarfare agents are popping up in National Institutes of Health, Food and Drug Administration, et cetera. And we know in the book Germs that the CIA was doing it, Department of Defense was doing it. But starting with the Reagan administration, they then really jacked it up. And then in the second Clinton term, he accelerated. And then after 9/11/2001, we've put $79 billion into biowarfare work. In constant dollars, that's about twice what we spent on the Manhattan Project during World War II to develop the atom bomb. So we're developing biobombs is what it amounts to. There it is. And we have now reestablished the offensive biowarfare industry that we did have before the Biological Weapons Convention, as revealed by Seymour Martin Hirsch. And along the lines of the old biopreparat program in the old Soviet Union, today we have about 14,000 scientists doing this type of Dr. Mengele work. And approximately, we don't know the exact number, maybe 1,500 laboratories doing this Dr. Mengele work.
And most of this work not going on in places like Fort Detrick and such, but in private corporate laboratories.
Well, it's going on in Fort Detrick. It's going on in U.S. government labs. It's going on in university laboratories. They bought all the 14,000 life scientists off. And universities and private corporations, right, they've all been bought off. And then the other thing, if you look at the mainstream news media, when they ask experts on this, they get all these people doing this biowarfare work. So, of course, they're not going to tell the truth. They go along with the CDC cover-up.
And now the whole world is watching. The United Nations is deeply involved. And maybe more importantly, Americans are scared out of their skulls of Ebola. Could this be the moment to expose this whole long and sordid evil affair?
I've said for years, this is a catastrophe waiting to happen, a statistical certainty. And now it has happened in West Africa. And it's no accident it happened over there, you know, against black Africans. You know, the black Africans have always been guinea pigs for everything by the United States government and Big Pharma. Plus, as you know, there are enormous natural resources on the west coast of Africa, new finds of oil off the coast there, bauxite, minerals, diamonds, you name it. And so now we see 4,000 U.S. troops moved in there. You know, the 101st Airborne and the Marines aren't equipped to treat anyone. They're going in there to set up a base and move AFRICOM in there. AFRICOM headquartered in Stuttgart, Liberia said, well, we're happy to have you. So we're going to have 4,000 troops. The headquarters of the 101st Airborne Division has already moved there, about 500 people. So my guess is, well, you know, we're going to have maybe the 101st Airborne Division there and more. So AFRICOM will be moving into Africa. And the Brits are moving in about 4,000 troops, last figure I saw, into Sierra Leone. Remember, Sierra Leone is a former colony. Liberia has always been our de facto colony. The French are already in Mali and Senegal and are moving into Guinea. So this is the scramble for Africa all over again, the Congress of Berlin. That's what's going on here, and using Ebola as the pretext. Big Pharma wants to jump in there because they figure they can make big bucks out of it by milking the American people. Most of these vaccines they're working on, I think, are more dangerous than worthless. Either they're worthless or they're more dangerous. And what you're going to see then, if you look at the catastrophic fatality figures that they're predicting there in the west coast of Africa, I think these vaccines very well could kill everyone else off. So what we're seeing here is sort of like the equivalent of the neutron bomb. The whole theory behind the neutron bomb was to kill the people off with the radiation, but all the natural resources stay put so we can steal it. So that might be the game plan here. The so-called vaccines, as I said, are many of these vaccines involve live Ebola that is just appalling, that's going to give people Ebola, and the others are worthless. You might as well give them poison pills or something like that. No research protocols at all. Clear-cut violation of the Nuremberg Code on medical experimentation going back to the Nazis. It's very clear if you read what's going on there, they've never made any effort to help these people anyway, period. All this is propaganda, a big show. As a matter of fact, I think last week, the week before, there was a meeting in Kenema where all the international government organizations made what I call an extermination decision, that henceforth no effort will be made to treat any of these people. They will simply be sent home with Tylenol, and that's that. And the representative there from Sierra Leone walked out and protested this decision. So the decision has already been made to sacrifice these people, and I think it was made at the beginning that they were never seriously interested in treating them. Hey, but it's just black Africans. When's the last time the United States, Britain, and France have ever cared about black Africans? And we know that Britain and France has a long history of killing millions of black Africans. The rest is just for show. Of course, the MSF and the Cubans are in there, and some of the private relief organizations are doing what they can. But the big guns were never serious to begin with. The UN is just going along with this. The WHO is going along with it. West Africans are on their own. They've already been sacrificed. All the West really wants here is the natural resources, and I think they'd like it without the people. The only thing we've seen successfully treating people is the blood plasma of recovered Ebola victims. But no one's really talking about giving that to West Africans. That's being given in Spain. It's being given here in the United States.
Do you think that the United Nations might be some forum for some country to raise this issue?
Yeah, I think if you get some of the African countries to take the floor of the UN General Assembly there and denounce what's going on, yeah. But you name me an African country that's willing to go up against the United States and say this is a result of U.S. biowarfare programs. Name me one. I'd like to know.
That was Professor Francis Boyle at the University of Illinois at Champaign. Green Party candidate Danny Avila is giving Congressman Charles Rangel a run for his money in New York's Harlem. Rangel has been in Congress since 1970 and was once the most powerful member of the Congressional Black Caucus. We asked Danny Avila why he thinks Rangel is vulnerable to a challenge from the left.
I think he's vulnerable to the Green Party, to Danny Avila campaign for Congress, but more than anything, I think, to the people he supposedly represents in the 13th District. And if we just very, you know, briefly take a look around at three basic elements, we see why we need a change there, and we need somebody, in this case, myself, to propose new legislation and propose new ideas and try to push the 13th District forward in a progressive way. One is, for example, gentrification. All over the 13th District, and we have seen how, you know, working people, even middle-class people, have been displaced, and as more and more we notice that big corporations, corporate America, is taking over everything. The rents have skyrocketed. Everything is just unaffordable, and those are policies, frankly, that we could say that Charles Rangel is not directly responsible for them, but when the heck has Rangel in all these decades protested, said anything, tried to do anything to stop the gentrification and displacement of working people in the middle class. Number two is police brutality. Again, we have seen over and over again how especially African-American young men, but also, you know, generally speaking, black people and Latinos, immigrants, have been the victims of police brutality, police harassment, unnecessary harassment, what is called the broken windows policies. And again, our dear congressman, and I've lived in this district all my life, you know, in the 13th district, I say my congressman hasn't done a damn thing. And finally, is the matter of labor and people's rights as workers, as working people. Again, nothing in terms of demanding, but I mean aggressively, not just, you know, for elections or politicians. Bill de Blasio in New York City paid lip service to raising the minimum wage to $15. I was at a rally with him last April 13th, I think it was, on 125th Street in front of McDonald's. But Bill de Blasio, after he gets in office, he forgets about all these things. He was a fast food workers rally in front of McDonald's. And it's the same thing with Rangel. In terms of not only $15 minimum wage, there should be a demand, there should be a right of all working people as a minimum, but it's just the general concept of workers having the right to organize a union, to have labor rights, and all those things have disappeared under the clock of Mr. Rangel, and he has done nothing. So Daniel Vila, as a member of Congress representing the Green Party, representing the people of the 13th District, we will at least take solid positions in favor of the interests of working people.
Well, to say that Charlie Rangel has done nothing about gentrification is really a damning charge, since the socioeconomic makeup of his district has changed totally over the past several decades.
Yes. Well, he has done something, and that is he's favored every single piece of legislation, every single step, every move made by business, by corporate America, to take over. Yeah, he supported it, so he just simply remained quiet. So he has done a lot for gentrification, we could say that.
And you talk about workers' rights. How many working people can now live in that district?
I live in Harlem. I live on the west side of Harlem. And I'll just give you an idea. There's a fellow who moved out of the apartment next door to us. Actually, he was evicted. He was paying over $700 rent. The new folks that moved in there are now paying over $2,000 rent. And they don't care. They got the money. They have the money. Working people can't afford that. And that's just typical of what has been going on in the building where I live and in the general area of the 13th district.
Well, those who support or acquiesce to gentrification say that's part of economic development. What are your proposals for economic development, a different kind of economic development in Harlem?
Well, I hate to break it down even more simpler than that. We could work our way up or down to economics, but, you know, it's just the whole concept in the United States, Glenn, just this concept of that working people, that people generally, people, human beings are not worth a damn, that human beings are secondary to the monetary economic well-being of those I would call and I define as the ruling class, as the capitalists. Because, you know, one other element I would like to make here to our listeners here is that I am a socialist also. I do not believe that this bankrupt, this corrupt system of capitalism can solve the problems of human beings in the United States or outside of the United States. I think we have to begin from the elementary position or point of view that over the last 200 years, the United States has been basically a war machine working havoc upon the species, the human species all over the planet. Over 50 million African Americans were killed in the slave trade here, and countless other millions have suffered as a result of that. The indigenous people who inhabited this continent, and specifically the geographic area known as the United States, genocide was carried out against them. Not satisfied with that, the rich, wealthy, basically white men who took over, but basically the corporations, but they're now defined it as, have gone abroad and, you know, they've invaded my country where I'm originally from, although I've been raised up in Harlem since the age of five. Puerto Rico is still occupied by the United States, too. They invaded Haiti. They invaded Mexico, took over more than half of Mexico. They invaded the Dominican Republic, the Nicaragua. We just go on, and the wars of aggression against Vietnam, Korea, what is going on now all over South Asia and the Middle East, and even now intervening militarily in the Ukraine on the side of fascists. We have to look at that first, then analyze that, and then part from that and say we need a system, a country which works for the interest of the human race, of Americans, of working people here. And then after we define that, then we can start talking about economic justice and so on and so forth in this country, which actually is very simple to do, because after you eliminate that huge military budget, which is just used for wars of aggression abroad, always inventing, of course, they're always inventing a new boogeyman, a new scare tactic. Once you eliminate that and you have all these billions, trillions of dollars to invest here at home, there's enough for everybody to enjoy free medical care, to enjoy very, very low, if not free, housing, to enjoy cheap or free transportation and education. So the money is there, the resources are there. It's just that the ruling class is gone ballistic, trying to control every single square inch on the planet Earth, which has natural resources.
Until rather recently, before he lost his ranking on important committees, Charlie Rangel was the top campaign contribution getter in the whole Black Caucus. What do you think that says?
I think that speaks very highly for him, for being the representative of the corporate elite of the United States, and especially in the 13th District. Unfortunately, you know, Glenn, and I hate to disappoint our listeners, Daniel Vila will probably not win this election, but we will get in the Green Party. Incidentally, the Green Party is being headed, the campaign for governor is being headed by Howie Hawkins, who is himself a worker. He's a union member, a member of the Teamsters. He's a UPS worker, and he loads UPS trucks. That's his real-life job, you know, when he's not running for governor of New York State. Our party is going to get more votes than ever. Unfortunately, however, I do not have the millions, and neither does the Green Party, the millions of dollars that Rangel does. And I tell everybody, you know, if I just had $500,000, just $500,000, I assure you that I would win this race hands down very easily. The reason why we are losing this race, why we'll most likely lose this race, is because the public does not even know that we are presenting such good, you know, our candidates, progressive candidates that represent better their interests. They're bombarded by the images that, you know, people like Rangel and other candidates, Cuomo, for example, they have all these hundreds of millions of dollars from, like you pointed out, corporate America. So they bombard and they inundate the media with their propaganda and their lies, you should say. But we're there. We're going to keep on fighting. And despite the fact that we are not swimming, exactly swimming in green bills, we will make a sizable, huge advance electorally this year.
Well, that calls forth the question, what good does a good showing by the Green Party, even in defeat, do for Harlem?
Specifically for Harlem, you know, we were walking this Sunday from 125th Street up to 145th Street. Last week we had a rally, we had a speak out in front of the Harlem State Office building. What we picked up, this is incredible, Glenn. I mean, like, you know, I've been around Harlem all my life practically since I was 5 years old. I expected in these little tours that we've had, these, you know, tabling and speaking out and so on and so forth, that there will be many or at least a few people shouting catcalls at us and saying, no, we want Charles Rangel to stay there and so on and so forth. We want Cuomo to remain in office. Not a single of the many thousands of people that passed by on 125th Street last Saturday and this Sunday when we were walking up Harlem and Washington Heights, not a single person, Latino, African-American, or any other ethnicity, said a single word in favor of Charles Rangel, which I think demonstrates that people of Harlem want change. Now, it is true. If we lose, we do not win. What it does, it creates a base. We have been growing very gradually, but as you know, the capitalist system is in a crisis. Wall Street, it's incredible. Wall Street just went down, you know, about 1,000 points in a month. And everybody's freaking out. All these billionaires are going wacky because they think that there's going to be another crash of the stock market like in 2007, 2008. It may not happen. But the point is that you would think that they have enough resources that they will be happy. But no, they are very insecure. And they know that there is a capitalist crisis. That's what it is. It's a crisis of capitalism. So it is precisely in these periods that working people look for alternatives. And at this moment, there is no other party that represents better the interests of working people, of the middle class electorally, than the Green Party. In other periods of American history, we could point to perhaps other parties that did represent the interests of working people. At this moment, this is the party, and we urge all people who are progressives, who are looking for change, who want to make their vote count on November 4th, please vote for me for Congress, for Daniel Vila for Congress, and also vote interally for the Green Party, for Howie Hawkins for governor.
Green Party congressional candidate Danny Avila in Harlem. Black public intellectual Cornel West has a new book out titled Black Prophetic Fire. West teaches at New York's Union Theological Seminary. He recently spoke at a town hall meeting in Seattle.
How do we proceed? First, we acknowledge we have to be able to come together and create alliances and coalitions that seriously target the most difficult issues, beginning with the litmus test, the legacy of white supremacy. That's the litmus test. That's the litmus test, you see. It's not because black people have a monopoly on suffering. Not at all. But in the formation of the United States, the fundamental threat to the status quo is when you fall in love with black people, when you're concerned about their plight and predicament and you make it central and fundamental to your analysis of class and empire and gender and homophobia and so forth. I mean, too many black folk, of course, stop when it comes to the issue of white supremacy. You say, no, we got some other issues. We got patriarchy we got to come to terms with. We got homophobia and we certainly got class. And I talk in the book about the re-niggerization of the black professional class. Oh, yes. Very important. Very important. We've got some very, very talented, smart, and brilliant black people in positions of status and prosperity and living well. But they're still scared and intimidated and afraid to tell the truth. And they don't want to reach out with the folk who are still catching hell. They want to say, look at me, like they're some kind of... No, some kind of peacock. Look at me, look at me. Peacock strut because they can't fly. No, we come from a people fly like eagles. Everybody knows we had different black leadership if black middle class kids were going to jail at the same level as black poor children. We'd have different kind of black leadership if black middle class kids had to go to the same school as poor black kids. We want no one to go to those schools, but poor children have exactly the same status as any other child. I don't care what class, I don't care what color. All of the six in this text had a linked fate with those on the bottom. They didn't romanticize the bottom. Of course, there's gangsters there. Because there's gangsters in high places, middle places, all places. I was a gangster before I met Jesus, and now I'm a redeemed sinner with gangster proclivities. It's inside of me too. So it's not a matter of just finger pointing. It's a matter of trying to make certain kind of choices and being true to those who came before. But it's something these days to see the parade of such talented black folk in high places. I'm not just talking about the brother in the White House built by black folk. But I'm talking about professionals across the board. What do you think about the prison? What's happening with Jamal and Letitia? Oh, they need to pull their pants up. Michael Brown had his pants pulled up. Kenesha did too. Oh, but when your child gets victimized, and it might be the rare ink spot in a vanilla suburb, but when your child get victimized, all of a sudden you get radical. Oh, we got to do something. We got a crisis. We got a catastrophe because my child is in trouble. Well, yes, we're going to be with you for your child, but you know what? What took you so long? What took you so long? Where's your sense of morality? Where's your sense of spirituality? And this is true for our poor white brothers and sisters, often overlooked, not just in Appalachia, but right here in Seattle. This is true for brown. This is true for yellow. The coming together. Each one of these figures in this text ended calling for some kind of multiracial alliance. And you say, well, it took Malcolm a little while, didn't it? Yes, it did. Because he was a gangster for a good while, Malcolm Little, until Elijah Muhammad loved him into his sense of possibility. And the depths of Malcolm's love for black people, we don't have a language for. But because it got stuck on the chocolate side of town initially, and he thought that white brothers and sisters were devils, and he's wrong about that, but he thought they were devils, but the love was still in him. And when he concluded, lo and behold, white folk not devils, it's just too many of them still engage in devilish behavior. He still had a point. He still had a point. But he said there's always fundamental spaces for John Brown and Ann Braden and Miles Horton and those white brothers and sisters to play a crucial role. Why? Because it's a question of integrity, honesty, decency, and virtue. And every human being can make choices in that direction. No one of us are imprisoned by our skin color, our gender, our sexual orientation, our regional identity, our national identity. It is a human thing. And oh my God, we need that today. And I'm just so glad and so grateful you all have taken this time to allow me to say a few words. I hope a strong enough catalyst to unsettle and unnerve you enough to either reinforce the fire you already have or to rekindle the fire for justice, the love of truth, the love of neighbor, the love of democracy, radical democracy that zeroes in on the dignity and the decency of those sliced on, called everyday people. Thank you all so very much.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.